So today I want to talk about, well, I've called it black hole thermodynamics, but what I really want to discuss is using that some of the Gauss-Kadarcy formalism to backtrack, to go back again to the variational principle and now try and tidy that up. So I flagged at the time that we did the Einstein-Hilbert action that when you did the variational principle, it wasn't really quite legal. I mean, we got the bulk Einstein equations, but it was a little bit open-ended because we'd had to assume that not only the variation of the metric, but also normal derivatives of the metric had to vanish at the boundary. So now that we've seen how to treat lower dimensional submanifolds in our space-time, of which the boundary is just a particular case, we can actually go back to our action principle and see if we can tidy it up, see if we can sort of complete it and make it clean. So, that's what we're going to just see if we can come up with some, using Gauss-Kadarcy, perhaps some extra term that will make our action well defined. And so just going to recap that the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action was the bit that we wanted, the bit proportional to the Einstein tensor in the bulk. Plus a combination of terms which were derivatives of delta G. So what we're really aiming to do, what we want to do is to add a piece, a boundary piece, to the action to cancel off this term. So so that's just a few bullet points of what we're trying to do. So we want a boundary scalar, and a really obvious scalar is, of course, the trace of the extrinsic curvature.
PM is
Particular
particular.
PTIC. Anyone else having trouble with my abbreviations? I sort of saw a few little. I'm not going to have the texting generation give me grief for abbreviations, okay? So if you don't know, just ask. Okay, just like the Ricci scalar was a natural bulk scalar to think of to put into a gravitational action, a sort of obvious scalar, if we're thinking about a submanifold, is the trace of the extrinsic curvature. So let's explore what that does. So if we're varying K, what we're really doing is varying the divergence of our normal and so varying the divergence of the normal has two pieces. And so you can think of the delta NA is really the variation in it's the variation of the metric at the boundary. And given that the metric at the boundary, you're saying that the induced metric is not going to vary. This is sort of encoding something about delta GAB. And then, of course, you've also got the fact that if you you could potentially have variations of your Christoffel symbols if you've got some local variation of GAB. So this is really, these two pieces of what we've got to sort of manipulate to see if we can come up with something that looks like that, that extra term. So our boundary metric H is going to be held fixed. That's the usual rules of the game for a variational principle. So we can think that all of the variation of the metric at this boundary is going to be encoded in NA. And so just so that I don't have to keep track of signs, I'm just going to assume that we have a time-like boundary. So I'm going to take N to be space-like, but you can go through and put the sort of relevant sign in front of the terms that I'm going to write down if N is time-like. So I have a picture of my, so this is my manifold here, the bulk. This is my delta M, some boundary. And so normally, as you say, your boundary, in this case, I'm going to, because I'm thinking about my gravitational action, I'm going to fix my boundary, which means that my induced metric HAB is also fixed. So what that means is that if I'm looking at delta N here, if I want to sort of work on that term for a minute, that delta N is only going to have a piece which is proportional to N because I'm fixing my parallel metric. But then I can rewrite this I'm just going through, at the moment it's not obvious why I've done that. Yep. Fixed. Yes, it's completely illegible, isn't it? Uh-huh. So this is my manifold here. This is meant to be my bulk space. And I've got some sort of boundary out at infinity. Or, I mean, really, I could just have a, you know, finite box of space-time, and then I would have a, you know, sort of fairly large, both time and space-like boundary. But I'm doing this in the normal way you do a Lagrange-type principle. Normally, of course, you're just dealing with an integral over time, so you have, you know, t equals a and t equals b. But here I'm imagining I'm integrating over some four volume, and this is the boundary of that four volume. And I've drawn it this way because in the example I'm going to do, it's actually going to be like a sort of space-like boundary at large R. And so it's just meant to be, this is some boundary which is being held fixed. So my variational principle is I fix the boundary, and then I just consider some arbitrary, you know, the usual rules of the game for Lagrangian mechanics, an arbitrary variation in the interior of my my observable, my metric, so of my field. And that means I've got my bulk equations, my Einstein equations. If I just take Einstein-Hilbert, I've got those normal derivatives. And what I'm moving towards here is adding an extra piece to the Einstein-Hilbert action so that when I vary that, I cancel off those normal derivatives. And so that's, it's not, I'm a scientist, I'm not an artist, right? So it's not very good, but I'm just trying to sort of represent the fact that this boundary is fixed. It's not meant to be dynamical in this instance. And so this is why I'm able to do some of these manipulations that I'm about to do. Yeah.
Compact manifold. Do you assume that you can have any manifold and put a boundary on it?
Well, no. In this case, I'm not thinking about manifolds with or without boundary. I'm trying to regularize the action principle for gravity. So I'm manually putting in a boundary because I want to. First of all, I want to formalize this variational principle for gravity. So I want to make it well defined so that the only thing I'm doing is keeping my metric fixed on the boundary, no derivatives. And then having made my gravitational action sort of rigorous or made it watertight, then I'm going to go and look at an example of a space-time to evaluate this action. And at that point, I'm going to have to truncate my space-time manually take a look in order to evaluate this. So it's not saying it's compact. This is not an actual boundary, a physical boundary. This is one that is being put in for the purposes of either correctly deriving the dynamical equations of motion for gravity or for correctly deriving an action for a space-time. So this is not meant to be some, at this point, this is not meant to be a physical object. That's not the way I'm approaching it at the moment, okay? Well, of course you can. So, right, so why have I done this? Well, what I want to do, here I've got a delta N, and what I really want are delta Gs so that I can cancel off those extra pieces in the action. So I'm trying to convert my delta N into a delta G. So that's where what I'm up to here. Okay, so as I sort of claimed that the variation, the metric, was encoded in G, and what I've used here is the fact that just as we defined our induced metric H as being G minus NN, G plus NN for space-like N, then our metric is therefore the induced metric H minus Nn. And of course, delta H vanishes. So that gives me a means now of expressing delta K just in terms of delta G, because of course delta gamma is simply, let me write that bit first. So delta gamma is just the GBC, sorry, G, well, the indices. Delta gamma is simply here the covariant derivative of the trace of delta G. So that's all I've written in the second piece. So now you can see that we're getting close to having something like that term there, because this is just grad n of the trace of delta g. So I've already got the first term. And so what I need to do is just kind of work on this second term to get it into a format where I've got the covariant derivative of delta g contracted with n. So if I multiply out now this derivative, the first term is going to give me a half k. So the next terms are simply giving me grad n of n, which is something that is not dynamical. I can set that, I could choose my normals to extend covariantly. And so the last piece that I get is simply a divergence of delta g. So I'm getting there, I'm nearly at an expression that I want. So if I now look at this term, this is what I want to work on. This is a sort of copy of two n's. I've got nn here. So I can turn that into a metric. So remember my induced metric is g plus nn. So this is really the difference between my induced metric and the full higher dimensional metric. So what I'm really doing here is I'm writing that hopefully with the right signs as H minus delta. So what I've done is I've managed to get something that looks like this part here is the part that we want to cancel off, yes? Sorry, this term. That's just that term. I'm just writing delta G shorthand for the trace. Because I mean this is the metric, so it's covariant derivative, yeah. So I've managed to derive something which is going to cancel off the unwanted normal derivatives of the metric. And so all I need to do is just kind of think about what's remaining and what this actually stands for. So if I work on this term here, this is going to be equal to the intrinsic covariant derivative. So I'm pulling the n inside my covariant derivative, and then I've got to subtract off the derivative of n. Which gives me an extrinsic curvature. So by looking at what the variation of k is, I've got a term that's what I was aiming for. I've got something which are multiplying delta g's. So I've got a k, extrinsic curvature, I've got a trace of an extrinsic curvature. And then finally, I've got a term which is a genuine total derivative. So this term will simply integrate to nothing, because normally a total derivative would integrate to a boundary term, but I'm already on a boundary, so there is no boundary of my delta m. So when I take the variation of the square root of the sort of metric times k acting on the boundary, I get these, I put that comma in, the equal sign in inverted commas to say that I've ignored the total derivative here. And so what I'm left with is the term I wanted, the normal derivatives of the metric. Then I've got this extrinsic curvature sitting here, and I'm almost certain I should have a half in front of this whole thing. And then finally, I've got minus a half k n b and c here, and then I'm going to also have minus a half k with the GAB there, and so this just gives me the induced metric. So what I'm ending up with is something that's intrinsic, an intrinsic object to the boundary, and something which is cancelling off that unwanted normal derivative in the Einstein-Hilbert action. Yeah. Because once I'm restricted to the boundary, I'm just taking the restriction of root g on my boundary. So it's probably should have written it in the first place. So it's a volume element on the boundary. Yeah. So it has to be. So covariant. So in other words, if I've added this extra term into my gravitational action, I thought that wasn't down. I now have a completely sensible variational principle. So the only thing I've got is something which I've sort of added that second term really there because I'm going to want to use it later on. But basically, it's saying that this is now a sensible variational principle. If I completely fix my boundary, then all I would get is a bulk equation of motion. So that boundary term has a name. It's called the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. And it makes the gravitational action now completely sort of kinematically or dynamically consistent. So I derived this for a variational principle, but as we'll see, you can actually use this type of formalism or interpretation to think of dynamical boundaries. So you could imagine your space-time as actually literally ending on a wall, and you could then think of that wall as having some kinematics or dynamics of its own. In which case, the second term that I've written down there with the extrinsic curvature, that would then give you dynamical equations of motion for the dynamical boundary. So it's sort of quite an, you know, it's quite a nice way of looking at these domain walls that I was talking about, or thinking about actual sort of dynamical brains or submanifolds in the space-time. Yep.
So if you're saying that it's dynamic, but H is still fixed.
So, well, in this case, I was using this as a derivation. You'd have to be just a little more careful, I think, about your, what you were doing with your coordinates. But you get the same result. So there's two ways. So there's two ways you can get dynamical equations for a codimension one submanifold. One is to think of it as literally an end to your manifold and do this boundary term. And the other is instead to sort of go in and locally look at the Einstein equations across a shell, a delta function shell, and they both give the same results. So I think you've just got to be a little more careful if it's dynamical, but you get the same thing. So what I want to do now is to apply this to computing Euclidean actions. So when I first introduced Gauss-Kadatze, one of the motivating factors that I mentioned was the fact that if you think about solutions to vacuum Einstein gravity, all of them are Ricci flat, and therefore they all would have zero action if the Einstein-Hilbert action was all there was. And so that seems a little bizarre, having, you know, an infinite family of exact solutions, all of which have the same action, and in fact, all of which have vanishing action. So it's a little bit strange when something like, you know, a black hole, so some non-trivial solution with energy has the same action as the vacuum. So to see how to use this. So if we were thinking about some sort of pseudo quantum gravity type of approach, sort of Euclidean approach, then we might want to consider a sort of gravitational partition function. So we might want to sort of try and do some sum over geometries which satisfy some suitable type of boundary conditions or some suitable class of geometries of the Euclidean action. And so if we were doing this type of approach, this might sort of come to being some sum over saddle points. So, for example, if we wanted to look at something at a finite temperature, we might say we want to look at classical solutions which have a particular periodicity, and then we'd compute the Euclidean action of our classical solution because we would assume that would dominate this partition function. And so we saw that the Schwarzschild solution, if we Euclideanized it, was periodic in Euclidean time, and therefore we might think if we calculate its Euclidean action, that would at least be some sort of saddle point to this integral. So let's just, don't think I actually drew this. So let's look at our Euclidean Schwarzschild. So in the tau r plane, if we look at very large r, d tau squared is just, we've just got ds squared is d tau squared plus dr squared plus r squared d omega squared, which is like a cylindrical space. We've got a fixed s1, which is the tau direction, and then we've got r cubed. So at large r, we've got something that looks like r cubed cross s1. And then at r close to 2 gm, we've got something that looks locally like r4. So the geometry of the black hole space-time really is r4, but it's metrically more like this. So locally, we come down to the event horizon, or the, what's the relic of the event horizon, and we're locally in a space that just looks like the origin in polar coordinates, but at large r, you've got the cylinder. So that's what the Euclidean Schwarzschild space-time looks like. And of course, delta tau, we calculated, was 8 pi gm. So this is a Ricci flat solution. So the Einstein-Hilbert part of the action is zero. Now I'm denoting my action here by I rather than S to emphasize that it's a Euclidean action that we're computing here. So. But it's the same thing. So what this means is that if I want to compute the action of the Schwarzschild solution, it's a pure boundary term. So this should be the action for my Schwarzschild space-time, but now I have to just think about how to compute that boundary term. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the surface, because I've got colored chalk, I'll use colored chalk, at some large r. So I'm going to put in manually a cutoff to my space-time, and I'm going to compute the boundary term. So you'll see why I've sort of fussed around by putting in a cutoff space in a moment. So I'm cutting off my solution at large r, and so this is my normal here. So that's the boundary, something at cut off at r equals r. So then I've got to compute my extrinsic curvature at this radius. And then if I look at what the induced metric is at fixed r, well, at fixed r, I essentially just blot out that dr squared term. So I've got a square root of 1 minus 2gm on r. And then I've got r squared sine theta, and then I'm integrating over d tau, d theta, d phi. Those are my three coordinates that coordinatize my surface at large r. So that's the integral I have to do, and I have to compute kr. So the normal to my surface is obviously it's a radial normal. To make it a unit normal, I've just rescaled by that square root of 1 minus 2gm on r, and then it's got a point into my space, hence the minus sign. So my extrinsic curvature is the divergence of this normal evaluated at r equals r. So I take that's just the divergence. So I have to take my derivative and then evaluate it at r equals r. So I'm going to get minus 2 over r, square root 1 minus 2gm on r. So that's the first piece from differentiating the r squared. And then I differentiate my square root here, and that gives me gm on r squared divided by the square root of 1 minus 2gm on r. So that's my extrinsic curvature. And so if I look at my integral there over on this side, nothing depends, well, okay, I've got my sine theta there, but my integral over d theta d phi is just the normal two-sphere integral, so I get 4 pi from that, and then I get a beta from the tau, and so everything else is just some number which is dependent on the cutoff r. So if I look at, put in my kr, so I have 4 pi r squared beta over 8 pi g is the factor just coming from the integral over tau, theta, and phi. And then I've got to look at kr times the square root of 1 minus 2gm on r. And so that gives me 2 over r into 1 minus 2gm on r minus gm on r squared. Okay, so what that means is, if I work out, you know, sort of multiply through, you okay with that? No. Beta is the periodicity of Euclidean time. So the beta came from integrating over tau. So what I've got there is something that's actually linearly divergent in R. So that's sort of kind of worrying. However, if I were not dealing with a black hole space-time at all, so I didn't have an M, that would still be linearly divergent. So what this is suggesting is that this is simply a sort of zero-point divergence. It's something where you have a divergence which is present even in vacuum. So that's not exactly unfamiliar. We know how we should deal with it. What we should do is subtract off our action for the vacuum for flat space. So what we have to do now is correctly subtract off our vacuum divergence. So it's not just as simple as drawing a line through that beta r term. What we have to do is we have to match our black hole space to a flat space, compute the action of that flat space, subtract it off, and that will give us the right answer. So, So this is Minkowski space-time. But notice, this is just a number. This is not a variable. What I've done here is I've taken, if you like, I'm comparing my black hole cigar for r less than r, and I'm really just matching it to an exact cylinder, which is flat space. But in order to compare the metrics precisely, the surface, so gluing the cylinder or comparing a cylinder with a cigar, they have to be exactly the same induced metrics for this three-dimensional space. And so while these terms agree, the time component of the metric will not agree unless I rescale my Minkowski Euclidean time. So I have to compare like with like, which means I've got to have the cylinder looking the same at large R. So my extrinsic curvature, K, is going to be minus 2 on R. So I simply look at the computation at the top and delete M. So that's the extrinsic curvature in flat space. So my background action is going to be, I slot in 2 on R, I guess, where is it? I think you've got to kind of put it together. Okay, so I slot in 2 on R over here, but now I do still have this square root here, square root of 1 minus 2 GM on R, which to leading order is just 1 minus GM on R. So the regularized action is the difference between the bare Gibbons-Hawking-Schwarzschild action and this calculated flat space action. So you see the first term, the linearly divergent term, is the same. So that's good. They cancel. And then what's left, so our regularized Schwarzschild, is simply left with this beta m on 2 term. So you've got 3/2 from the bare action, you've got 1 from the background flat space action. And so what you're left with is beta m on 2 as being the Schwarzschild Euclidean action. So if I go back now and apply it to this sort of slightly illegal method of looking at black hole thermodynamics, if I apply my calculation, my partition function calculation, we can now calculate the entropy using this saddle point solution. So we've got beta m on 2 is our action. Partition function is going to be e to the minus Euclidean action. So I take the log and I just get minus beta m on 2. And so for the entropy of my black hole, see that it's proportional to beta squared. So I can again just rewrite. We saw that beta, well, I wrote it down somewhere, Euclidean Schwarzschild. The periodicity is 8 pi gm, so that's beta. So here, this gives me 4 pi gm squared, and so I can rewrite that. As 4 pi times the Schwarzschild radius squared over 4g. So in other words, we derive a familiar relation that the entropy of a black hole is proportional to its area. So in natural units, we've got, I think, we've got sort of factors of C on the top line, H bar on the bottom line. So this means that black holes have a huge entropy. Which is, of course, a little bit inconsistent with the fact that they're characterized by very few charges. So this is also true in any dimension, at least for a Schwarzschild black hole. So I just want to finish off by making an observation using some of this thermodynamics in higher dimensions, kind of point out a curious little feature about higher dimensional black holes. So we talked about Kaluza-Klein black holes, where we looked at forming black holes when we have a periodic extra dimension. And so the simplest black hole was just a Schwarzschild solution that extended in the extra dimensions. That was like a black string. And we also formed charged black holes by either boosting in the internal dimension or fibering our extra dimension in a slightly a non-trivial way to get a magnetic monopole. So here I don't want to sort of think about necessarily about charged black holes straight off. What I want to do is look at some of the consequences of the fact that, you know, we've got this entropy formula for these Kaluza-Klein black holes. So let's look at the standard Kaluza-Klein uncharged black hole. So this is really a black string. And we'll say that it's got a horizon radius of R plus. The length of the internal dimension is L. So then the mass of this Kaluza-Klein black hole is R plus L over 2G5. So remember that G5 was simply G4 times L. So the entropy of this, well, the entropy is just a quarter of the area. So the entropy of our black string is going to be 4 pi R plus squared L. So that gives me the area of the horizon. And then I've got to divide by 4G5. So that tells me what my black string, my Kaluza-Klein black string is. I've got a mass term and I've got an entropy term. And I could rewrite my entropy in terms of the mass because I can simply replace R plus by M. So here, this is pi L on G5 times R plus squared, which is 2G5M on L, all squared. So we've got 4 pi G5M squared on L. Okay. So let's compare this now with our five-dimensional Schwarzschild solution, and let's just see if we find anything curious. So a five-dimensional Schwarzschild solution has just got an S3 horizon. It's got some horizon radius. That can be either RS or R5, depending whatever you want. Now, if we apply the Myers-Perry relation for masses, remember we had a D minus 2 times the area of the 3-sphere, so that's 2 pi squared. We then had our Newtonian potential, which was proportional to, remember, it was 1 on R squared. So we've got this RS squared here. And then we've got to divide by 16 pi G5. So that's our five-dimensional mass. And then if I calculate the entropy, the black hole, it's again the area over 4G. So that's just 2 pi R5 cubed or RS cubed over 4G5. So I can write that again in terms of my mass. I think that should be 2 pi squared, shouldn't it? Yeah. So in this case, what I've got multiplying out, and hopefully getting it right, got root g5 and then 8 to the 3/2. So I'm going to have so it's 8 times 2 to the 3/2. So again, a root 2 times 8. I think. Does anybody want to check my arithmetic there? Because I didn't write this down. Oh, yep, 3 pi. Got my 3, yep. Thanks. I think everything else is there. And the master pen, it's the most important part, thank you. Forgot my maths. Right, so if you look at that, you see that the string has an entropy which is proportional to the mass squared, whereas the black hole has an entropy which is proportional to the mass to the 3/2. So you've got different dependencies of entropy on mass. So what that means is, for a given mass, if you then ask what's the entropy for a given mass, it depends sort of how large the mass is, or in particular perhaps on the size of the internal dimension. But you can see that because of this different dependency, maybe, you know, one of these will be thermodynamically preferred at some scale. So let's actually look at so this is a different dependence. So they would be equal when this is the black string entropy. And that's the black hole entropy. So if I absorb, first of all, I can do some cancellations. I can cancel off that, and that becomes 1/2. I can obviously cancel off 1 of the square root of G5s. So if I square both sides just to get rid of some of these square roots, then I'm going to end up with, so G5 M over L is going to equal so I've got my pi's. I think I've got all the factors there. So this 4 pi, this 4 goes with that to give me a 2. And then that pi becomes 1/2 if I cancel it off with there. So 2 root 2 squared gives me an 8. But this thing here is just G4m, which is the usual Schwarzschild radius. Okay, so what this is saying, therefore, the left-hand side was the black string entropy, the right-hand side was the black hole entropy. And so it's telling you that in a Kaluza-Klein compactification, if your length becomes too large relative to the mass or the Schwarzschild radius of the black string, then the black string will be entropically unstable. What's the opposite of preferred? Can't remember. Disfavored compared to the black hole. So this is, what you're seeing here is a thermodynamic manifestation of something that, although I've derived this in the context of a Euclidean calculation, this is telling us that we expect black strings to be unstable if we make them too long. So our black string should be unstable. And in fact, if you do a stability calculation, so a linearized stability calculation around the black string, you see that it is indeed unstable. So this is confirmed by a dynamical calculation. And in fact, you find that this instability is quite generic and persists for a lot of those black brain spacetimes that I was telling you about. So I think I mentioned this at the time, but this black string instability is quite generic, and it's the first sort of example of higher dimensional gravity being different to four-dimensional gravity. In four-dimensional gravity, black holes are unstable. They may have a lot of puzzles, but in the sense that they have a huge entropy but very little information. However, there's, the singularity always seems to be hidden behind an event horizon. This does not seem to be the case in higher dimensional gravity. So again, this sort of also spills out the black ring solutions are unstable. And so it's sort of, and in fact, recently it was shown by, again, Perimeter's very own Louis Lehner and Franz Pretorius, that this instability does seem to persist right down to fragmentation of the black strings. So that's known as a Gregory Laflamme instability. So again, that's Ray Laflamme, Perimeter's very own. You seem to have a lot of names in gravitational physics here. And so we showed this instability almost 20 years ago. So it's nearly older than you. All right.